Welcome to the Source Refresh Small Business Supply Chain Podcast. I'm your host, Chandrika Venkatraman. Join me as I talk to small businesses from across the world to learn about their supply chains, their support systems, and what keeps them moving. In today's episode, I'm talking to Peter Shah. Peter is the president of Harris Spice, a leader in sustainable spice sourcing and processing. Harris Spice is also a member of Southern California's Minority Supplier Development Council. In this interview, Peter shares insights into the spice supply chain, along with valuable lessons for small businesses on how to navigate unpredictable crises, such as the COVID-19 pandemic. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Peter, welcome to the Source Refresh Small Business Podcast. What we want to focus on today is just understanding small business supply chains, understanding what COVID impacts you've seen pre-COVID versus post-COVID, as well as talking through some of the great strides your organization, all of you have made in overcoming some of these challenges, as well as what open challenges do you still have on the table that you're looking to resolve. For starters, would you like to introduce yourself and your organization, as well as, you know, what it is that you guys do?
Thank you, Chandrika. First, thanks a lot for having me on this podcast. I'm the president of Harris Spice Company. We're based in Anaheim, California. But essentially, we're one of the companies that started its roots in India in the spice space. And so in the US, we've been supplying spice for over 40 years. And our journey has been one of growth from the supply chain perspective at the origin and into the destination country. So over the years, we've developed a very strong business that takes us not in the origins, but in the destination countries, supplying everything that's got to do with spice. So we're through and through a true spice company.
Fantastic. So some of these origin countries, can you name some of them?
India, Vietnam, Turkey, and China are amongst the largest countries that we've sourced from. And with the advent of a very high care spice that the US and most of the Western countries require, we've had to pare down some of the other countries that we used to routinely buy from, for example, Brazil, Mexico, and spices from Africa for certain exotic ones. Indonesia, for example, was a huge origin for Harris. But over time, as the technology around spice processing improved and the faith and trust grew in the origins, few of the origins couldn't cope, so they fell by the wayside, but they became secondary suppliers to our major plants. And but again, we try to source from as many countries as possible.
Fantastic. So that does, I bet, involve a lot of international travel for you.
I love it. Chandrika, for me, it's like a dream come true, because having grown up in India, you grow up eating spice. And then the fact that the management here, when I was coming up down the ranks, offered me an opportunity to come and work in California and do spice, I was sold. So, it's been a dream come true. I've traveled many countries, and it truly puts our business and all the cultures in perspective for me. It's always I'm dealing with people also mainly.
A regular consumer, right? Where would we see your spices? What are your brands? Would we see it masking under any other retailer brands? Where do we see you guys?
That's a great question, because as Harris, you know, we always aim to be as close to the consumer as possible. But our journey was more B2B, starting out from the origins and supplying bulk material. But as we progressed, our ambitions grew and we got closer. So today, as we enter the retail space, we're still very small, but we've started with some with a licensed brand under the Newman's Own brand of spice. So that is still a fledgling. It's in year two of its promotions, but We've started lining up the brand in Hannaford stores. We're working in Ingles up in the East Coast. And we're also launching in Amazon pretty soon under the Neiman Zone brand. So that has given us a quick, you know, but expensive start into the branded arena. And eventually, if things work out and with our supply chain, we're also trying to launch under a Pep and Zip brand, which has a nice ring to it. You know, we're avoiding any traditional brand names, but Pep and Zip is meant to bring the younger folk, as well as the chefs in the food service space, you know, a name that rings fast and true.
And that's going to be for spices?
That's going to be for spice. So we're still in the early stages of that. We do a lot of private label for a lot of customers who are already in the space. But again, we've carved out a niche for ourselves in this space for us.
And the niche is it spice blends? Is it grilling spices?
So niche is in terms of, you know, a highly gourmet type of spice with, you know, with a sustainable angle to it. Because, you know, in spice, you have such a range. And it's very hard to clamp down the range, even within the seasoning space. So for us, getting this licensed brand of Neiman Zone, which donates all its profits to charity, especially with our sourcing from sustainable sources as much as we can, that's where our sell is. And that's where we're trying to carve a niche for ourselves to be able to get behind such brands.
Wow. So a brand that makes a difference on both ends.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Are we ready to dive a little bit into supply chain? So you did touch a little bit on that. You know, you guys source from several different countries. What are, like, you know, if you had to talk about your end-to-end supply chain, maybe, you know, talk about it for one or two of your key commodities. What does that look like?
Right. So ever since we started back, you know, 35, 40 years back, it was operating out of the origins and understanding the origins. That's where Harris cut its teeth in terms of working closely with the farmers, because back in those days, it was the Wild West of spices. You could never guarantee anybody any contracts. You could say you'd book a great contract, but never get the product. So when Harris started, it was the first thing that came to our mind is that we should be able to take possession of material. And so that's where we started at working with the farmers at the base level, having the funding necessary for them, for us to have access to material. And then getting that material shipped here on time and to be able to deliver every single pound. So that was the base supply chain that you could guarantee to customers as well as to the farmers.
The duration, that's pretty long, right? Because you're talking growing it, harvesting it, and then bringing it into another country. What kind of timelines are we talking about here?
So we never endeavored to grow because it was just not our forte. But almost always we knew the growing areas and how the farmers needed the funds. So I would talk in terms of how we outlay funds. So anytime we put up funds from the day we pay the farmer to the time we deliver to a customer, it could be easily 6 months before we get our money back or longer, depending upon the payment terms to the end customer. So from that process, we're taking a fairly raw black pepper, for example, which, you know, is what a farmer cleans to a very basic level, but clean it further to be able to sterilize it for microbial parameters and then put it on containers and safely put it up in a warehouse here in New York, Anaheim, or, you know, across the nation. So that's our end-to-end control as much as we can. And that's how we've grown over the years.
So you guys buy directly from farmers, right?
Who are growing as much as we can.
As much as you can, who are growing it specifically for a contract that you have in place, right, with them. And
yes. So what we've also done is, to your point, right? Not all farming is easy for us. So what we do is we'll contract with certain farmers in red pepper and black pepper, where they will grow to an international standard, such as the Rainforest Alliance standards, or an IPM, or Integrated Pesticide Management Program. So this way, the farmer has the incentive to grow it the right way, as long as there's a buyer ready for the material. So we don't put our hands directly into the growing, but we'll contract with these farmers.
And is that sort of similar for the organic space as well? if you had to source on?
Yes. See, for Harris, when we put our mind to steward something, and organics for us, I always call it the third wave, because the first couple of waves were a bit more, you know, like everybody finds something trendy, they all jump into it without knowing what it is. And when you kind of sift through all the pepper, for example, you find out the truth that it's not really organic. And so the supply chain is sometimes full of, I would say, folks trying to get into the action real quickly, but really without understanding what they're after. So we've got into the organic space about 2 years back. That was actually in 2019. That was our real first step, because it's the third wave. It's the more important wave. Many companies are looking for more depth in your program. So we've started actually now assessing fields where we can control, you know, with our farmers, especially in Indonesia. We've started a project where we'll have a person going across the fields, ensuring that the farmers are educated, taught, and grown product in a pure organic format. Now, we can't do it alone. We'll partner with international NGOs who provide expertise. We'll partner with local banks. Then we'll partner with companies who share in the philosophy of what a true organic program is. So we've started that endeavor, but not unlike our usual contracting, this is just a higher level contracting.
Talking about COVID, right? I know we talked a little bit about, you know, your main spice supply chain. Do you have any other, you know, main ingredients, anything else that's very critical to your manufacturing process that you guys source?
Absolutely. I mean, we were just like one of other companies that were forced to react. The stop and surge back in 2020, you know, really brought out, you know, the fact that an event like the pandemic, you know, in 100 years, you know, is a once in a lifetime event. But it also saw companies who were very well entrenched in the supply chain and how they practiced their supply chain before the pandemic were able to get on their feet faster, because they could easily muster up the strength, the resources necessary to react faster. And while we were in a good space, we were not 100% capable yet. We had to really understand what this new normal meant for our business. And I think at that time, we looked forward to our customers and our farmers, two opposite end of the spectrums, and easily understanding that both had different needs and different reactions within the supply chain. Now for us, we supply a good portion of black pepper to the United States. And this black pepper ends up in retail jars, it ends up in blends, it ends up in food that is, you know, goes up to the fast food restaurants. So it became apparently clear to us that if we don't somehow really boot up every possible resource and, you know, not to worry about the cost, because at this point it was about just making sure your customer is able to get their product on the shelf. Because you go to a store and you see everything empty, even these jars are running out. And then we started seeing all this new demand. We're thinking the business is growing, but no. It was just folks looking around because they couldn't find the product. That's when we realized that, you know, we had to take a step back, assess the situation, and first we had to take care of our customers and our farmers, you know, and our origin suppliers that both had different needs. Making sure one understood the other was very critical, and we started putting a plan together. And at that point comes the real test. You worry about cost. Well, you worry about making sure that the consumers are taken care of. And that's what we led ourselves by.
Do you want to talk any specifics on, you know, any one or two challenges and any accomplishments that you guys had?
Absolutely. Some of our customers, they really work off of safety stocks. And so all of them, you know, said, you know, we'll move our safety stock requirement 1 or 2 months ahead. So that meant that we had to likewise produce more faster and put it on ships to be able to get over here. So we actually got some of our customers into stock position for at least 6 months of their requirements to 8 months of their requirements ahead of time. And that led to other challenges like needing additional warehousing space. You need to make sure you have your packaging material covered well in advance, because you could not operate from a 90-day lead time anymore. You needed to just give them a year's worth of requirements. It was tough. I'm not saying we did it, but it meant paying up. It meant finding the space necessary. It meant getting all hands on deck. And that was a big problem because we couldn't get the labor. As in the second part of the pandemic, it was all about the labor issue. So we have to get all these little ducks in a row. Okay. And more importantly, from the origin side, they were facing crippling lockdowns. For example, in Vietnam, what I'm very proud of, our team, once the government ruled that, you know, due to the lockdown in Vietnam, you'd have to have all your employees either go and live at home or live on site, which means we had to have over 100 people from our factories live on site, eat on site, and work on site. It was something I'm so proud of because they pulled it off. You can't measure it. I mean, in different parts of the world, different reactions, but everything that we look at today is all about the people. They stepped up. Even the people here in our plant in Anaheim, even, you know, there were fears and concerns, but those folks who had to absolutely come to work in the tight grips of the pandemic, they did so. Our leaders, our, you know, quality and production leaders, they had to come. We're thankful that we came through unscathed in terms of health and worker safety. We managed. But it was a trying time because on one hand, you have to run your business and your customers. On the other hand, you have to take care of your employees who are your business, literally, because without them, you have nothing. And so how we were able to manage and pivot ourselves, and some of us lucky ones were able to work from home, but we made it a point to show up at the factory afterwards because you needed to show that strength, that support.
Wow. What would you say are one or two issues that you might have that does keep you up at night, or, you know, just issues that you think, oh, like, I really do wish we could find solutions to this? What would you say are some things that you guys experience?
Well, it was transportation from the origin. The ocean freight situation really kept us up at night because you had this evolving situation around the world. And for us, most people, when they look at ocean freight, they look at it from a micro perspective that, okay, I want to bring something from point A to point B, right? But really, between the point A and B, there was all these other points, global disruptions, that at one point, if I could say, there was the Suez Canal vessel issue. There was the slowdown in Europe where a lot of empty containers were stuck. Then all of a sudden, China's lockdown issues, the port congestions in Los Angeles. And then you start looking at all these points and, my God, your one biggest route is the ocean, and that was in such a turmoil. So for us, when we were thinking about taking on business, we had to really understand what that lead time would be. So I'm telling my folks that, you know, rush as much as you can, and I'm telling the salespeople, you know, obtain as much lead time as you possibly can from the customers. So what was 90 days, we now ask for 150 days. Because what you think was normal is, A, you couldn't find containers first. And once you found the containers, you couldn't find the vessel bookings. Once you found the vessel bookings, you couldn't get the proper transit routes. You could think, oh, I normally get something from Vietnam to New York in 40 days or 35, 40 days. It was now sometimes 60 days. Yeah. Well, even if the cargo came here, then you wouldn't know if the ports were, you know,
if they could clear
giving your containers out to you. Your truckers were stuck. They asked for more money. And then the truckers didn't have, the warehousemen didn't have your labor. Right. So the thing is, that's what kept us is I'm thinking that once it's out in, once the inventory is in your warehouse, you're OK. But getting it from the origin to your warehouse was something we followed up so much. And I think that kept us fairly awake because you had to do so many follow ups. And then the steamship companies, you know, they're in business, too. You see them. They're, you know, they were hiking their rates every single time. So here I have contracts that are fixed contracts, but now I have to pay the extra ocean freight, extra demurrage charges at the ports, detention time, you name it, Chandrika, we were are facing costs. But no matter, I think we told ourselves, you don't want to disturb your customer every time. You kind of take it for now and then approach them later on. And guess what? You know, they all were facing the same issue. So they could commiserate on that fact.
So any of these, like, so this sounds like a cost heavy operation, right? And, you know, you just pointed out earlier that priorities were getting materials, right? Yes. So cost becomes secondary somewhat. Now, is there a rebalancing? Like, has that happened already, or are we still in the same situation of availability is my number one concern?
Things have started to settle down. I think, like with anything in life, what goes up must come down. So for a while, almost every customer understood the increases that we were asking. They were astronomical. I'm not saying they were, 5%, 2%. We're talking 20%, 30% rises. And while many of the customers were absorbing those, they felt that time was not right for them to, bicker about cost, because customer was able to pay it, and then we are used to a certain convenience and everybody's paying for it. But I think throughout the whole process, you could see various things start falling into place, like the ocean freights, because a lot of pushback was already coming in. We're paying already 6x, 7x times the normal freight. So now your freight has settled down to about 5 times.
Okay.
And 6 times. So within that little range, your oil prices that shot up now have come back off. And then obviously with the higher inflationary costs, the concern is that demand will start to taper off. So, and you're starting to see the pushback from customers also that, Peter, now it's time for us to talk numbers again, and let's not get carried away with costs, because you don't know, the consumer keeps on paying with their wallet. And once they shut that wallet down, because they just can't afford it, and you start seeing them actually take their dollar somewhere else.
Yes.
And so that is a message across the whole supply chain, including the ocean freight companies. And we've started hearing that some of them have started to reduce their asking rates because they don't want to lose the action. They're making a lot of money. So hopefully, we're starting to see that decline, or at least I would say conservatively speaking, it's settled down.
Any words of advice for other small business folks who are watching the podcast? Anything that, any practices, any best practices that you guys have that you think is worth, sharing, please do so.
Absolutely. And what I would let small businesses know that, adaptability to a situation in certain times will prove your resiliency, that you can take a problem, adapt to it, and stay resilient. But what it taps into it is your creative resources. What's your end focus? And that's what we've always looked at, is that the customer is the end focus, that their plans shouldn't shut down. And then it made us adapt faster, be creative. It made us also make all the other people in the supply chain by active communication. When in a time of crisis, most people clam down, they don't talk, and they think, they'll be called out. But no, I would say adapt, communicate, and be as transparent as possible. And good things happen, and that's what we learned, because your customer understands, right? And the one who's furthest away is your vendor overseas, and your farmers who are overseas, they don't know what's going on to the end consumer. So that whole process of communication and being transparent to both sides saw us through. And so our business survived, and that's what he says, right? It's the strong who survive. The ones who adapt survive. So I would tell every small business, learn adaptability and be creative in your resource management, and you'll survive.
Fantastic words of advice. Thank you. Thank you so much, Peter.
My pleasure, Pranika. Thank you for having me over.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. You can get more information on today's episode in the show notes or at source-refresh.com/podcast. To hear more episodes, please subscribe to the Source Refresh Small Business Supply Chain Podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from.